Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Before we begin, a quick content warning. This interview contains discussion of spiritual abuse, narcissistic leadership, and the systemic failures of church institutions to confront harmful behavior. Listener discretion is advised. Today's episode features the full uncut interview with investigative journalist Rebecca Hopkins of The Roys Report. In this conversation, we go deep into her reporting on Alan Scott. From his early days in Scotland, through his leadership at Causeway Coast Vineyard in Northern Ireland, and ultimately to his controversial takeover of the historic Anaheim Vineyard. Rebecca walks us through the red flags, the testimony she's gathered, the troubling patterns that emerged, and how the broader structure of the Vineyard movement allowed this kind of leadership to go unchecked. She's covered institutional abuses across the evangelical world, but the story of Alan Scott and the silence that surrounded his rise is one of the most disturbing. This is a conversation about the cost of platforming charisma over character, the damage caused by unchecked spiritual authority, and the voices who refuse to stay silent. Here's my conversation with Rebecca Hopkins. All right, Rebecca Hopkins, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So before we get started, tell people a little bit about your background and the work that you do with The Roys Report.
Yeah, I'm a freelance journalist, primarily work for The Roys Report, but also have done some work for Christianity Today and Daily Beast. And so the work I do for The Roys Report is I do investigative journalism in the area of church abuse.
Yeah, and so obviously that's exactly why I asked you if you'd be willing to come on today is talking about, so the podcast I'm working on right now, is kind of looking at predominantly two major events within the Vineyard movement specifically. Obviously, Duluth being one of the big ones, but the other one is one that you've largely covered for the Roys Report, which is the Anaheim situation. So for people who are unfamiliar, tell folks a little bit about, first of all, I think it's important, obviously, to talk about Alan and Catherine Scott, who are the primary folks involved in this story. Who are they? Give people a little background on who they are and where they're from.
Yeah, I think some people may have heard of Catherine Scott because she's also a musician, so they may have heard her songs. They are, well, he's originally from Scotland, but they built a really big mega church in Northern Ireland called Causeway Coast Vineyard. And it's kind of known for, I mean, kind of his thing is that he grew up from 6 people to this huge mega church. Then they moved to the States a few years ago, got connected with Vineyard Anaheim, maybe under some, suspicious circumstances. That's the flagship church of Vineyard. So that kind of brought him into the American mind. He was pretty well known in Vineyard circles, but then especially in the UK. Yeah, he became kind of infamous in America since he got connected with Vineyard Anaheim.
Yeah, the timeline of events is very interesting. There's a lot of publicly available information. And of course, like, as you said, he started this church, this Vineyard church in Northern Ireland and really grew it, grew it to quite the, state of flourishing, I guess. And that really gets you noticed within the Vineyard circles. If you can really grow your church and for all intents and purposes, it looks on the outside as if it's thriving and healthy, that really puts you on the map. And to your point, he was sort of being asked to do national conferences and things of that nature. So what brought him from Ireland, though, all the way across the ocean to Anaheim, California?
Well, in his words, according to him, God did. The way he puts it is there were 35 to 37 prophecies that he was fulfilling by coming to the States. He left Causeway Coast first. So he leaves Causeway Coast in, let me see what year that was. I think it was 2017. He moves to California without a job to Orange County. He didn't move there to become the pastor of Vineyard Anaheim. In fact, he told a couple people, and this is according to a lawsuit that's been filed, but as you mentioned, it's in the public record. He told one or two people that he didn't, wasn't interested in the job, but he had, connections there. So he starts talking with people there. And then, one of the things that this lawsuit says is that he inquired about the asset Vineyard Anaheim, and it's got like $62 million in assets. It's a very wealthy piece of property, as you can imagine, in Orange County, been there a long time. And then at some point in 2018, he starts applying for this job that he had said he didn't want. And in fact, according to the lawsuit, he had told a couple people that he was disenfranchised with the Vineyard movement, wasn't really interested in getting back involved with them. And then all of a sudden he applies for this job opening, and then other things unfolded from there.
Yeah. So talk about that a little bit, because again, in this sort of fight in between the folks who were part of that sort of original generation behind Vineyard Anaheim and, the fact, again, they kind of call it the house that Wimber built. That was his original church, and them leaving the Vineyard there are a lot of suggestions that, there were some early signs that this may be something, or direction that they were headed, I should say, in the sense that, like, for example, kind of changing the people who were on the board and sort of removing any obstacles that may have been in the way that would have prevented him from being able to ultimately pull them from the movement.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that was what he was kind of doing early on, whether it was staffing or board member, he kind of cleaned house. And put people in that were like his culture was kind of the verbiage. And then the board members that would back him. And I think what made people kind of still get on board with him, though, is that, as I understand it, even though this was the flagship Vineyard Church, it, I think, was dwindling a little bit. And so his whole thing was he was going to revive it. So I imagine in people's minds, it's like, well, yeah, you got to make changes if you're going to bring some new life, right? But yeah, the changes quickly became toxic, according to some of the staff that worked with him at that time.
Yeah. Tell people a little bit about, to go back a little bit, because I think you have to kind of go back to his time in Northern Ireland. In the aftermath, he kind of leaves before the investigation into allegations behind his behavior had even been completed. And so I don't think they even wrapped up that particular investigation for another year or two after he had left. And so talk about sort of the initial allegations that were brought forward, some of the murmurs sort of behind the scenes, ultimately what Causeway ended up doing, which was to hire a third party firm to come in and kind of investigate it. And so talk about some of the murmurings behind the scenes and then ultimately the allegations. And then ultimately, what did Trusted HR, the group that they brought in, determine?
Yeah, I find with these leaders that go as far as people like Alan go, just in general, they don't just kind of drop out of the sky and start spiritually abusing people. But it can be interesting because there can be stuff that happened decades ago that at that time might have even been somewhat public or at least known to that community that just does not get into the public record. It doesn't follow them to the next place in any kind of transparent way. So, I mean, as early as back in Scotland, and this is in the kind of this original piece that I wrote on this, there were some problems. So he grew up in Scotland. He and his brother got connected with a church that became Vineyard, and his brother ended up pastoring this church. Well, his brother ended up having an inappropriate relationship with a woman in their church. Alan at this time, he was kind of in and out. He was going to Bible school, got married during this time, but he was like a lay leader, like a non-professional leader in the church with his brother, which is kind of a common theme for Alan. There's a lot of family, at least in Scotland and in Northern Ireland, there's family connections in the churches there. Which, doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing, but it can be a little bit hard for accountability. Your brother is not going to really try to turn you in and hold your feet to the fire usually. But anyway, so John has this inappropriate relationship. Alan, as this leader in the church at the time, according to the sources that told me, He is kind of tasked with dealing with the fallout. John does resign, although he continues for decades to come to still preach in vineyard churches. So I don't know, like he's still preaching anyway. And so even from that point, there was some documentation that came out from that that showed people weren't happy even with Allen's leadership at the time. They felt like he was manipulative, controlling, really not really trying to be very transparent with this. So he shortly after that, that's when he moves to Causeway Coast on the heels of this scandal. It's kind of interesting to think about it. I mean, like the narrative is he grew this church from, you know, six to, you know, probably thousands. But also there's this part of the story that I'm guessing most people did not know, that he had just come out of this scandal with his brother. And then sure enough, in Causeway Coast, the manipulation, the control continued. A lot of it because of wanting to grow it. And so putting pressure on people to have these really big God stories and maybe not always super true or just, yeah, the main point is you have to get out and have these really big conversion stories. Also, he had a very godlike presence and he cultivated that. It wasn't just that, oh, people admired what he had to say and felt like he was wise toward what God would say, but that he was very much like, yeah, I know what sin you have in your heart. And God tells me what you say about me in your house. This is what came out of the investigation that Causeway did. And also some sources told me this as well. So yeah, and one thing I didn't quite ever get the piece of is why he left Causeway Coast. I mean, yes, God told him apparently, but I mean, was there anything else, right? So I don't know that part. Maybe you're finding that part as you talk to other people, but I think the investigation happened after he moved to California, if I understand it right, which means he leaves Causeway Coast. He gets to have a narrative where God told him to do this big thing in America, or at least to go to America. But behind the scenes, there's all these people he has hurt there too. Whether they're talking about it to each other, you know, is a little bit unclear, but certainly things weren't just going swimmingly there. There were problems there as well.
Yeah, that's something I've definitely noticed in my research as well, is the timing of it seemed very convenient at the very least, where he seems to leave these places as things are starting to get a little hot there and then moves on to a new location where they may not be as familiar with some of the allegations, some of the baggage that perhaps he comes with. And then all of a sudden he finds himself in Anaheim in a leadership position that he claims he didn't want to begin with, until, as the allegations say, that he became aware of the financial standing and the assets, and then sort of, you know, takes that position. And then within a couple years, you know, the board members are very different. It's very apparent based on the current staff that he's brought in a lot of his own people, and then makes this shocking move to pull, you know, the flagship, you know, church completely out of the Vineyard movement, shocking a ton of people, including John Wimber's own widow, Carol, who was part of that lawsuit. So tell people about how that process went, just in terms of how quickly and sort of quietly it happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shocked everybody, including staff. So yeah, so he came in with like, he's gonna grow Vineyard Anaheim. He's going to kind of save it from its maybe possibly dwindling state was kind of the narrative, right? So he puts all this pressure on staff. There's some things that are coming out that aren't great either. 2020 happens. This big plan to really grow it is now in question. You know, churches are not doing great as far as numbers. 21, he tells some staff that God has prophesied that in a couple years, the church is going to have 20,000 people in it, like this huge number, right? And they're already under a lot of pressure. And that's kind of where some of the toxicity comes. And he's trying to purify it, but in a really weird way and really not great way. And then, yeah, early 2022, all of a sudden, he tells, you know, Vineyard USA leaders, yeah, we're pulling out. And, you know, the staff is shocked. The Vineyard USA is shocked. There's kind of this implication that the board is on board with him, like his board is on board. But again, he's already kind of pushed out the people that were not the yes people. And yeah, so then by a few months later, Carol Wimber and several other founders and former board members sued him and his church, because he changes it. Like he completely leaves. He takes it out of Vineyard Anaheim, calls it Dwelling Place, and says God told him to do that as well.
Now, It's curious. So like a couple things I noticed in sort of how these events unfolded is he's sort of, as I mentioned, bringing in some of his own people. And one of the individuals he brings in is a pretty well-known worship leader, Jeremy Riddle. And there's these rumors behind the scenes within the staff of just in terms of he clearly has his own vision for how things should look and you know, be perceived by the world. And so he definitely has his own vision for how Anaheim should look and what it would become. And it's almost as if he's modeling it off of, like, for those that don't know, Jeremy Riddle kind of comes out of the Bethel Redding church system. And it's almost as if, like, Bethel and their whole, especially their whole music arm, is really sort of like the new generation of Vineyard. What Vineyard was sort of back in the early 90s, early 2000s, where they were the hot, trendy church that had like the best worship music. And now that sort of has kind of ended up in the hands of like Bethel with the Jesus culture and things like that. And so he brings in Jeremy Riddle, somebody who was a worship leader, who's written some popular songs under that umbrella. And it's almost as if he's now sort of moved into this space where he's trying to create his version of the next generation of Vineyard.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting that he brings in Jeremy because, yeah, another famous name in music. And that just has a way of kind of giving validity to what he's doing. This is a new, exciting place to be. And yeah, really interesting. And you mentioned about kind of how he's trying to do, like, he's definitely creating like a specific culture. But it got weird because, I mean, sure, bring in some great musicians. There's nothing wrong with that, right? Sure, great. But he does this thing where he talks to staff kind of in staff meetings about body types.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. Like, I don't know what he's thinking at this point.
Talk about that, though, because it's this very specific, like, weird system. I don't know where he gets this from, but it's like, it's based on numbers. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. So from what we can tell, just like the materials, the teaching materials, he gets it, it seems, from Jim McNeish. I'm not sure if that's how you say his name, but he's Scottish. And he has this, like, body type system. I think there's 5 numbers. I can't remember. But, you know, every body type is associated with a personality. So tall and thin would be something, and then short would be this. And so the body type, according to like staff meetings that we have these recordings of, that he doesn't like he does not want this body type on his staffing, is type 3. So this is somebody that has a larger torso and thin legs. And apparently their personality would be that they're power hungry, you know, difficult to control, just not going to fit in, you know, that kind of thing. And so he kind of works to, according to these sources, he works to push out people who fit that body type. And I mean, it's weird. Oh, and speaking of like other famous musicians, so another person that he has there is Noah DeBolt, who's a drummer, especially like at that time, like he was growing, his influence and reach was really growing. He's a drummer, but his wife apparently is body type 3, according to, you know, Alan. And so they get pushed out. And yeah, it got so weird. There's this one quote from one of the staff meetings that we got the recording of that he talks about that type three are the ones who sow the seeds of demise. So I don't know.
The world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange. And it's interesting, you know, what you just referenced. There are a lot of audio recordings of staff meetings. So it's not even just, you know, hearsay or, you know, third party, you know, recounting stuff that had happened in meetings. There are recordings of these meetings that are out there that you can hear. And to your point, you know, a couple of former staff members have gone on record, you know, there's stuff on YouTube out there where they've recounted these very things happening. It seems like Jeremy Riddle also very much on board, you know, because he's captured in these audio recordings as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So talk about just kind of where they're at now. So the last thing that, you know, my understanding is that initially, because one of the important things that we've kind of covered in an earlier episode that'll come out before this one is sort of talking about the way that the Vineyard is structured. And one of the big things that they kind of lean into is this idea that the local churches have autonomy. And so you have a national structure, but the local churches have a lot of individual power to kind of do their own thing to some extent. And we kind of dive into that a little bit. But ultimately, this idea of autonomy is what Alan Scott's able to use to pull the church out of the vineyard. And ultimately, that's what the courts say, well, we kind of have to stay out of this because of the fact that you have this baked into your structure that they're allowed to do that.
Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, when he took Vineyard Anaheim out of Vineyard, changed the name's Dwelling Place, the communications that he had with Vineyard USA were starting to kind of reveal how he deals with problems. And so then some of that now becomes public. And what it did is it brought forward some of these staffers that had these really bad experiences with him from both Vineyard Anaheim and also from Causeway Coast. But then now where do they go? Because you're right. Like, so now he's pulled it out of the movement. The movement was already pretty loose and not really super high on like top-down accountability, coming into a local church, telling them what to do. However, where this also kind of intersects with kind of recent history, Vineyard history, is that during this time, Vineyard was doing a guidepost solution assessment of their structure and their problems. And so there was kind of a way they could report some of their concerns, not that Vineyard USA, especially at this point, could really truly do anything about it. But at least there would be a way for them to be heard, and then also for them to possibly be in some kind of report, which just helps other people. At the very least, it warns other people, or it warns the current congregants. And so that basically kind of stirred up, gave some momentum to people to start speaking up. And that's when they also came to the Roy's report and helped with our investigation as well, and were sources for that. But I mean, kind of this lingering question is there accountability for him? I mean, even in Dwelling Place, there was a time when they said, sure, we'll investigate. But the attorney that they hired to investigate these allegations against Alan was the same one that, as I understand it, the same one that was defending him in the lawsuit. So that's tricky. I mean, like, what's the accountability there? So then the sources definitely didn't want to talk to kind of that process, speak to that process. So yeah, it's really difficult for there to be accountability. Having said that, I mean, the reason why we know a lot about this is because people were willing to start speaking up, which is so difficult for them to do because there were a lot of personal connections people had with Vineyard. And so that's always hard to kind of speak up about, you know, the church that your relative started or something. And then same with Causeway Coast. But a lot of just that momentum of on both of these continents, people are now coming forward, really helped kind of push through and get some of the truth of this finally out there, these decades long problems.
Yeah, and it's been interesting to see to what extent Vineyard USA, the national entity, has or has not, you know, taken steps based off of, you know, as you said, there's now been three different independent reports with three different organizations on two continents that have come forward with suggestions and with, you know, with some solid proof at this point based on the number of people they've spoken with that says, hey, there were definitely problems here, you know, years before, you know, this happened that should have been warning signs that, hey, maybe we should have dug a little bit deeper into this guy before we handed him the keys to, you know, the flagship church. And so you've got Trusted HR's report now out of the UK. You've got, as you mentioned, Guidepost report. And then, you know, with the Duluth situation, you've also got Grace, their report as well, that sort of all three sort of point towards some structural issues within the Vineyard, especially from the national level. So, you know, out of the folks that you talk to and doing this report, what is your sense from the national perspective of how do we prevent these types of things from happening, and how do we prevent abuse in the church more effectively going forward?
Oh, that's a really big question. I feel like there's real answers to this, but it's like there's not enough solutions, or people aren't taking them because it keeps happening. But one of the very early things that kind of on the national level in Scotland, in the UK, when there was somebody from the Scottish church, again, this is the one before Causeway Coast in the timeline, John Scott's church, Vineyard Church, a member of that church had written a letter talking about Alan, how he dealt with this whole thing, asking for help to a person who was in that UK Vineyard level, like on the national level. And the person didn't respond to the letter, but came for a meeting at this church in Scotland. And according to my sources, said to the people, you need to just follow leadership right now. Like, stop complaining. You need to just get on board. And I mean, if that person had a protocol and followed it, for responding to allegations of control, manipulation, any kind of abuse of power. I'm hoping we could have prevented this whole thing. And I imagine there were other opportunities, you know, in the whole timeline when people, if they'd felt safe enough to speak up, or if Vineyard had done a better job of kind of on a national level in the UK, done a better job of really keeping tabs on this situation. I don't know. It's so hard for people just on the human nature level to overcome that thing in their head when they see a successful person. They feel like that person has more integrity. Like they can't be the one that's doing the wrong thing. And then the person who is bringing up the concern, there's just this thing where people just feel like, oh, they're just a traitor, they're a complainer, they're a whiner, they're too sensitive. Like that is the plight of the whistleblower, is they have this piece of the truth that organizations really need to be able to be healthy organizations. And it's so, like, I don't know, people just don't believe them, especially in places of power. I just feel like there should be protocol to help them get over that, like get over that hump of, I don't want to believe this person, where you say, I don't know if I believe this person or not, but at least we need to put them in some kind of process for there to be some kind of external way to investigate. There's just too much at stake and churches need to do better. And even with, I just don't feel like it's a really valid excuse to have this whole like, well, we really leave it up to the local churches to you know, police themselves or whatever. I just feel like there's more we can do. And so much of the time people are looking for somebody outside that system to hear them. And I just feel like there's things they can do. Because at the very least, don't platform that person. Don't move that person around. Don't let them speak in conferences. There's things they, I just feel like there's always things you can do to stop and prevent abuse.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Yeah, absolutely. And it definitely feels like the national part of the entire structure sort of like leans into the autonomy when it's convenient, when they're like, well, that's a local issue. We'll let them handle it. And they're kind of hands off until it blows up sort of in their faces. And then they're forced to deal with it like, oh, gosh. So a lot of similarities, a lot of parallels between Anaheim and the Scotts and the Gatlins. I know you didn't cover that story necessarily, but the Gatlins and Duluth, you know, again, very, very much platformed based on the fact that they were hitting certain metrics that are very desirable within the Vineyard, you know, predominantly, you know, the fact that they also grew this church from very, very small to this huge, seemingly successful church, had very kind of harsh expectations and had a lot of the same accusations of like spiritual abuse and manipulation and very heavy-handed spiritually loaded language that they would use to justify what they were doing. And again, you're right. There was, at that time at least, no legitimate reporting system, because I think you put it out earlier too, and this is absolutely correct and very similar in this situation too, between, you know, the John Scott situation and Alan. And you know, how do you put a person in a situation where they are expected to make decisions based off of allegations or accusations against a family member? Well, same thing with the Gatlins. You know, when somebody would complain about Brenda, the person that they had to report that to was Michael, her husband. And so there are these inherent conflicts of interest and probably some major nepotism issues within the structure.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it just so frustratingly impossible to be heard and believed and have there be any kind of change. And it's really heartbreaking because the people who are hurt are usually some of the most dedicated staffers. Like they're the ones, like one of my sources was this woman who was the college pastor. And during the pressure of like, we have to grow, he was telling her she needed to go convert 3 people an hour before she could be done with her workday. You know, these salvation quotas, I mean, just really icky. And so like she told the story of being in Walmart late at night and just like crying from the stress of trying to find enough people that would stop their grocery shopping at that time to, you know, say a salvation prayer. And what is that even doing anyway? Like, that's not, you know, a good discipleship model. But it's heartbreaking. It's just so hard and frustrating to see.
Absolutely. So I've got a couple questions for you, and these might be some hard questions. So I if you can't answer or legitimately don't know the answer, that's completely fine. I completely understand. But I have to ask. I have to do my duty. So when it comes to the Roy's Report, one of the things specifically that came up about the Roy's Report in particular, I had a source who was one of the early reporters on the Duluth side of things. And he reported, he made a detailed report to multiple levels of senior leadership at the Vineyard National level, almost like, gosh, 11 years ago now. And at the time also sent a bunch of internal sort of information and materials to Julie Royce and said, hey, this might be a good thing to report on. So maybe the way to answer this question is, how do you guys sort of, what process is in place to decide what sort of things to cover and what sort of things, you know, maybe not?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, one of my roles at the Roy's Report right now is that I check the inbox, basically where people send tips, and I gather the initial information, vet, you know, is there enough sourcing, that kind of thing. And then I pass that on to Julie, who then makes the decision whether we can investigate. And so I know my part of it. I'm not sure all the things that kind of go into her thinking, but I can certainly share, you know, what I'm looking for. And some of this is just, it's journalism. It's the limits of journalism. So what our standard is we need some on the record sources. We get a lot of anonymous tips. They're great. They give us some good information. They kind of help us to be watching for things. Sometimes they kind of validate. If we get several tips on one church, we're like, okay, you're on our radar now, you know, even if those people aren't ready to go on the record, it really helps us to kind of watch for things. But, and we do for sexual abuse victims, they can be anonymous. That's pretty standard across the board for journalism. But yeah, the Roy's Report, we require everybody else to be named on the record sources. And so that can be really difficult for people. And so that's kind of the first thing I'm looking for is, are you ready for this? Is this what you're willing to do? Are there multiple sources? We need more than one source for like investigative pieces, bigger pieces. Some documentation is really great. And there's also like kind of newsworthy parts where just, I don't know, that can be a lot of different things. There can be some really unique aspect that we're like, okay, that's pretty different. Let's really kind of consider that one because it's pretty different. If it's, you know, a famous person, that's one that most journalists are going to try to cover. But also the Roy's Report does a lot of investigating of churches you've never heard of because it's just what we do. But yeah, I would say the sourcing is really important. And then who, you know, is there an available journalist at that time? And there can be some hard realities of like, there can be just some intense times when we're doing so much breaking news or these other investigations we've already been on. And we're all like completely tied up. The journalists are just tied up. And so we just can't, you know, take on a new investigation. And that is, I would say, kind of today's reality. And the Roy's Report is fairly new. I think maybe 2019 was when she first started doing this specific kind of journalism. But there's been a lot of growth of just what we've been able to cover and staffing, although we're still a pretty small team. I think only Julie is the only full-time person. The rest of us are freelancers and contract workers. And, you know, I'm just part-time, so I can only do so much. But yeah, I would say if there's a group out there that's like, we want to expose this, we want to go to a journalist, figure out how many numbers you have for going on the record, get your documentation ready, get kind of a quick summary. Journalists are very busy. So if you can have like a 1 to 2 paragraph summary that a journalist can very quickly look through, that really helps like figure out the biggest concern or the core concern. We like to see what you've tried, how else you've tried to report the situation. So yeah, like if you brought it to the, you know, to the very top leadership and they've mishandled it and you've got documentation of that, like that is gold. That is so helpful. So yeah, those are the kind of things we're looking for. You know, it's tricky because there can be complicity in these situations. And so I feel like that's probably been maybe even underreported. I mean, a lot of times it's easy to kind of eventually find, you know, the bad guy, right? but then everybody kind of wants to pull away and be like, oh, we had no idea. We didn't know. Oh, you know. But a lot of times they did know at least some red flags and some initial reports. And also it's possible they've contributed to like a systemic problem that has allowed that particular quality. Like if you are in a denomination where numbers is your metric for success and you've cultivated that mindset, and then you have a pastor comes in and kind of takes it to, you know, the nth degree where he'll just run, you know, throw people under the bus for the sake of numbers success. Well, it's probably not just that guy, right? Like he's been supported in that mindset and in that process. And that's that kind of work though, the culture work, I guess. It's a lot harder to do. It's a lot harder to change. I feel like that's where the really important change happens. And that's where the change that a lot of whistleblowers would love to see happen. Like, please just get to the foundational stuff. Please don't just get rid of this one guy. But get to the foundational stuff, I think, is what they're just like craving to see. But it is so hard to happen because people just want to protect themselves. They want to protect, you know, the reputation of the organization. They find all these different ways, like attorney-client privilege, to hide how they handle things instead of really being transparent about how they handled every step of the way. And then, like I said, like, you know, journalists are like, we're pretty overwhelmed. And so we're kind of this like outside way, you know, to look into these things. And like, we'll have stories come across our desk where I'm like, man, I can see how people have tried everything, every internal way to report this, and it has failed, and they have nowhere else to go. And I know that we're not going to be able to get to all these stories. And it's so frustrating because, of course, they cannot get the system to correct itself because the system is complicit. And it just takes so much work for the system to actually take the time to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, in today's day and age, it seems almost like it takes, you know, an article by like a Reuters report, or it takes like a podcast, you know, like mine, to put things out there in such a public way that it almost forces the system to, you know, for one reason or another, whether it's PR damage control on their part or if they are legitimately making efforts to improve. But it sort of feels like it takes something like that to kind of foresee the type of systemic change that needs to happen to stop these things from occurring in the future.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things you can do to prevent abuse. And I think there have been some good changes, like background checks have become more common. So that's good. Just more awareness of what narcissism is, what abuse is, what domestic violence is. You know, culturally across the board in Western culture, we've learned a lot over the last few decades. I feel like there's always a way for an abuser, an offender, though, to find some other way around things. That's why, like, one of my big things is you have to be willing to listen to the people on the ground who are seeing it or experiencing it, those whistleblowers. Like, that has to be part of your prevention process, not just your response, but your prevention, because that's the only way. I feel like that's your most consistent way to prevent future abuse, is you got to listen to those early people blowing that whistle, because they're seeing stuff that you're not seeing. And if you can listen to them, you can prevent more of that. But man, it just, they are made the problem. They are considered a threat in so many cases. And these denominations and church movements, I mean, they're just shooting themselves in the foot with this by not listening. I guess that would be my one thing. I'm like, please just listen to these people. They're telling you something you need to hear.
Yeah. And it feels like the solution, you know, in a lot of ways, it's funny. My daytime job is I work in the corporate world for a huge bank. And a lot of the ways in which, you know, and this is by no means exclusive to the Vineyard by any stretch. I think we see this in a lot of different evangelical movements, especially in Western Christianity, but very much operates like a corporation or like a business that's selling a product. And when you operate in such a way, you also have to have certain things in place to prevent abuse from happening. And so if you're going to operate like a corporation, you need to have an HR department, you know, and you need to have nepotism laws in place to prevent, you know, conflicts of interest. And you need to have those things. And it feels like, okay, this seems like the solution is very easy. It's like, okay, you have a national office, hire some HR people, you know, and have a number, like if something went awry in my company, you know, tomorrow, I know that I have an HR confidential reporting line that I can call, who will get back with me very quickly and help advise me in the situation and help make sure that there's no conflicts of interest in the sense of like the way that we solve for that problem. Investigations always take place, you know, victims, you know, or alleged victims are always listened to. You know, it's that, so it seems like that would be the very easy way to go. And yet we don't see churches doing that.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting, there's almost like a couple of different skill sets. And I mean, I'm a strong church going Christian, still involved in my church. And yet I'm very okay with saying there's a lot of weak spots in Christianity. I think one of them is that, you know, we're family and all you have to do is kind of call the God card and kind of explain things away with God told me to do this, or this is why I'm doing this. Where, yeah, I think a lot of times the corporate world can do better at this, but our weak spots are just, you know, it's what makes us so warm and accessible that we can kind of come in and be part of a community, but there's just not the safeguards in place because we just, I think we don't appreciate the evil of abuse. We're pretty naive to it. And then also because we're all just kind of a big family, boundaries are a lot trickier. Like there's just not as strong of boundaries. They're kind of even looked down upon. It's really tricky for like people who work for a church because that's their employer, but also their boss might be their spiritual father as well. I mean, that's just like, that's some weird stuff. How do you navigate that? That's just a lot of like dual relationship kinds of things that you wouldn't get in like kind of a normal job or a normal volunteer situation and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're awesome, Rebecca. I really appreciate your time. You do great work. Like I said, you know, when we first started chatting, I really appreciate your reporting on this. It was super, super helpful to me. And just, you know, what you guys are doing is super important in a situation where a lot of times victims don't have someone to be a voice for them. And so, you know, the work that you do is massively important. And again, I just appreciate you spending some time and helping put this story together.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And, you know, journalists are only as good as their sources. They're the ones who are the really brave ones. We're honored to get to be a part of exposing these stories. But I just, yeah, every day I'm just so glad to see the courage of whistleblowers. And it gives me courage then to also, yeah, be part of the exposing it as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca. And just appreciate the work you do and keep at it.
Thanks so much.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.